So without a doubt, one of the most challenging things about leadership is being able to process the criticism that comes with the job. Whether you are a youth coach, high school coach, college coach, or you coach the pro level, people are emotionally invested in your team. So the criticism isn't going to always be constructive. Sometimes it will be emotional and heated. But I know some of my greatest growth as a leader, it came when I stopped trying to block out all the criticism. Because honestly, that just doesn't work no matter how hard you try. My greatest growth came when I started to learn from the criticism that was warranted or true. And the criticism that wasn't true or warranted, I would ask the question, why would this person feel this way? And just being curious led me to discover better ways of leading and to move on from that criticism. Now, in part two of our conversation with Jack Easterby, we're going to be talking about a few things. And one of those is handling criticism as a leader. In December of 2020, Sports Illustrated released an article criticizing Jack's leadership role within the Texans and painted him as this villain. Now, in today's culture, people are so quickly to accept what they read, which is disappointing because in that article, there's not one source or individual that was cited within the article. It was just a bunch of anonymous sources. Now, I'm not saying Jack, you or myself or any other leader doesn't make mistakes. We all do. We all blow calls. We all screw things up. But when criticism attacks our character, or it dehumanizes us as an individual, as a human being, that's the hard stuff. Like, that's really, really hard for us. And we've all experienced it. Every coach has gotten maybe that nasty parent email or the text, you know, accusing us of not caring about the athlete, even though we've poured so much into them, we've sacrificed so much, our family sacrificed so much. Or we've had that, you know, moment where someone gets on social media and blasts us as a leader. So we've all experienced it. But the thing that was disappointing about that article in Sports Illustrated is it really honestly failed to quote one of the many, many, many people around Jack who know him and have a relationship with him, because people that know him to be authentic, loving, hardworking, and yes, talented at what he does. I mean, I remember being at the New England Patriots training camp a few years ago and on the sideline where the family sit and watch, and the way people talked about him, the impact he was having in their husbands' or their sons' lives, that was incredible. And then to meet a couple of players afterwards and the affection they had for Jack and the connection they had with him, that was inspiring for me. So it's hard to see such an incredible person be blasted in these ways, just like it's really hard for the many coaches that I get the privilege of supporting to get that criticism as well throughout the season. But this is the way of sports, and this is the way of the world. And in today's episode, Jack's going to offer some great advice today for all leaders on handling and processing criticism, as well as some other great advice on stepping into new situations, changing roles or teams. Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast. My name is JP Nerman. I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Nate Sanderson. The mission of this podcast is to help all of us, listeners and ourselves included here, to build better team cultures, become better leaders, and become better people. I'm also the founder of TOC, a sports consulting business that provides practical resources and education for coaches, as well as one-on-one coaching for coaches. I know from my own personal experience, coaches need coaches. We need support along the journey. If you want to learn more about that or our resources, check us out at tocculture.com. Also, there, if you subscribe to our weekly newsletter, you will get the notes to this and every episode. If you really are invested in improving as a leader and improving your team's culture, I'd also encourage you to check out my book, The Culture System. It even has a few Jack Easterby references within the book. You can learn more about it at myculturesystem.com or just head on over to Amazon and just search for The Culture System. All right, let's get right into the second half of our conversation with Jack.
Well, I think one thing that's interesting about your story, you know, as we've kind of started with the J.P. Nerman days at South Carolina and moved through the NFL, is that there is a consistency in your perception of your personal mission in how you're interacting with others, regardless of whether that's team chaplain or you're helping more with a team, you know. And as you transition then into, you know, in your career to Houston, just for the listeners, you know, just to give a little bit of context, it seemed like there's, from the outside, you know, looking in, a lot of new roles that you were stepping into. And yet, just from what I hear from JP, when we talk about you and keep tabs on you, you still seem to be driven by the consistent mission of your life even though maybe your job and responsibilities might have been different in a new organization. So I wonder if you could just kind of explain a little bit of what that transition was like. Because as you mentioned before, you know, one entity to another can be a very different experience. So going from New England to Houston, you know, what was that kind of chapter like for you?
Yeah, well, I think I would go back to just what we just talked about in relationship to, you know, I think what you demand of yourself has to be independent of the entities that you work for or with, right? So I think, you know, if you're talking about a role or you're talking about a specific opportunity to do your job, I think that what you demand of yourself has to hover above what the job demands of you or potentially what the coworkers are demanding of you. And so what my family and I have always demanded of each other is that, you know, God is always watching, that you have to give your absolute best, right? That you have to love others and expect nothing in return, that you have to, you know, honor people, that you have to care unconditionally. And things like that, I would say, hover above the entity that I've worked for. And so in sports, you know, obviously the roles of all sports teams, and as I mentioned, sports organizations vary tremendously. And so when I was with the Patriots, or for that matter, at the University of South Carolina, I did a lot of different things, whether it was academics or a devotion or being an administrator and managing people or camps or you know, overall hiring searches, coaching searches. I've done all those different things. And I think that the demands of myself and for my family and I have always been the same. But then the entity has its own needs. And so, you know, obviously each organization has differences in relationship to those needs. And so Houston obviously is one of the newer organizations in professional sports. Really, really enjoyed my time in Houston with the people there. Was blessed to learn so many different things and serve in different ways to hopefully help that next iteration of that organization. And I think that it would be more of a testimony of where that organization was, or potentially where the Patriots were, or potentially where the Chiefs were while I was with them, versus me and my potential, you know, title or whatever. I don't quite get concerned with that as much. It's more specifically where that organization was. And Houston has gone through some really cool things, some really cool evolutions over the last several years. And I think that where they are now is even more indicative of growth and an opportunity for them to step forward with great people that are there and continued, you know, evolving or let's just say iterative processes that can hopefully help them make, you know, even better strides for successful seasons in the future. So, yeah, it was a time of transition, I think, in a lot of ways for me, a time of transition for the organization, a time of transition for the NFL. And so I think when you put a lot of transitions together, sometimes obviously there can be challenges with transition, but just really, really enjoyed those different strategies and or opportunities in a way that I think was both helpful, hopefully, to them and then for sure helpful to me.
You mentioned you had some learnings from that experience, and I'm curious because I think a lot of times as coaches, we change organizations, we change teams, and as you mentioned earlier, every circumstance is different. You know, Nate's on the podcast here has shared like 2-3 years ago he had made a transition into a school, and you know, it didn't work out for him in that situation. You know, and there's always that challenge of a transition of moving into, you know, from head assistant coach to head coach, or just head coach at small town school to big time school, or, you know, public school to private school, or, you know, mid-major to big time. So just from your experience and your learnings, I was wondering if you could just share some of those that might relate especially to how we navigate those transitions.
Yeah, I think that, I would say navigating transitions in general, you know, I'd say what I mentioned earlier. I mean, the premier thing is you got to stay yourself, right? You have to stay really double down on your values, on who you are, on what you're about, because if you begin to change that and you have circumstances changing, then you can feel, you know, very unsettled in how you are leading and how you're navigating transition. So first of all, you have to stay yourself. You have to be yourself. You have to stay true to what you know is your calling and or your skill set to be able to help. If you do that, regardless of how it works out, I don't think you'll have many regrets if you stay yourself. I would say just in transition in general, one of the things that's very difficult to do is you want to offer answers to the perceived new challenges very quickly, because in transition, you're trying to solve problems at an expedited rate. And so I think to push back from that during times where things are a little bit different or changing, I think is probably the right thing. I think to say, all right, I'm going to be myself, right? But I'm also not going to, you know, give you the cliff notes to an answer if I'm not sure all the information. So I think during transitions, you have to process more information with less answers than you would in a normal environment, right? So if you're in a normal, stable environment, you've been in a program 3 or 4 years, you may have a parent complain and you kind of know the background, you know the situation, you know the precedent of how you handle that situation. And so you can navigate pretty quickly. But when you're in transition, you have to slow down those answers. You have to slow down maybe the speed in which you give decrees or give principles out, or potentially even give answers out, because you know you may not have all the information yet. And so sometimes, so I would say be yourself. I'd say slow down a little bit in relationship to how you give answers. And then the other thing is, I would say, is sharing with yourself and your inner circle all of the things that are going on to make sure that you don't miss something. Meaning that if you're writing notes every day, if you're taking really good notes, if you're sharing with those you love, your family, the people that are your support system, all the things that are happening, you know, they will remind you, or you may potentially review a note that would remind you that something that maybe you're putting too much importance on or not enough importance on to maybe help you auto correct it, right? Because you may have somebody just glance and say, hey, you know, it's a new city, it's a new team, it's a new something. And somebody may just say something, you know, hey, think about this. And then you're on to the next thing because you're in transition. And that may be the thing that ends up, you know, actually changing everything, right? And so, you know, I think of recruiting, right? Like a lot of times in college, you know, a new coach is transitioning to a new town, you know, and he's, you know, hiring staff and he's doing budgets and doing all this. And next thing you know, he spoke at a high school clinic. He met a high school coach who actually resulted in him signing the best quarterback in the history of that school, right? So it was that speaking engagement that really changed everything, which, you know, is obviously you can gloss over if you're not paying attention. So to me, it's stay authentic in transition, stay true to who you are, your values, make sure that you understand that you probably don't have all the answers and that you need to listen more, and obviously, you know, not feel like you have to be provoked to an answer or a decree. And then I would say lastly is write things down. Have that inner circle hearing your talk, hearing your what you're learning, so that they can potentially help you or keep you from making a mistake, because you will, because during transition, we all make tons of mistakes.
I love that. And I could have used that soundbite right there before I took my job in 2012, Jack, because I went in there with, you know, I had coached in Europe, I coached professionally in Europe, and I come into a high school job thinking, you know, I have the plan, I have the secret, I'm going to bring European basketball to Chattanooga, Tennessee, and everything's going to be great. And I didn't go in and ask questions. You know, I didn't try to learn about why things, what had worked before and what hadn't, you know, worked before. And that really came back to bite me, you know, is in the end of the day, you're talking about there's be curious, come in, ask questions and take notes. And I know you're an avid note taker, you know, when it comes to everything, whether it's conversations and stuff. And that's one of the things I love about my role now, working with coaches and coaching coaches, is, you know, we get on a call, we talk every week about what's going on with the team, and I'm taking notes. And I try to be that sounding board for people to kind of just point to one thing here or another that they might've just missed, you know, which I think is huge for coaches. They need that. Another thing that I see coaches struggle with today a lot is handling criticism, you know, and it's just, we're, like you mentioned there, the parent email. I mean, it probably was 10, 15 years ago, it was the parent email, but now we have coaches that get blasted on Facebook and Twitter by parents and fans and stuff. And I know you know, you've had to handle some criticism here recently. Seth Wickersham writes about it, and It's Better to Be Feared. And, you know, it's just about your time in Houston. I'm just curious, how do you stay true to yourself? How do you process and handle the criticism that just comes naturally with every coach or any leader in sports?
Well, I don't know if I've always handled every bit of criticism well. I think my wife would probably tell you there's things that have probably bothered me more than others. So we're all human. I think I would say the first thing is, you know, the evaluation of you as a leader by people who don't have full context is always going to be limited. And so when you are being evaluated by a parent or by an athletic director or potentially whoever it is, you're evaluated by people who are never going to have the full context. And so I think that with those in your staff and those potentially in your university or those in your, you know, that you're working for and alongside, you should want to give them as much context as possible. So naturally, those evaluations and those criticisms become more educated over time. But I would say, you know, dealing with criticism, I mean, listen, it really digs deep into who you are as a person and your ability to believe truth over lies, your ability to, because again, if we're saying people are being evaluated with no context, then we're saying they're probably going to project and or assess things that are inaccurate. And so that becomes, you know, let's just call it what it is. It's a false truth that's being projected about something because of lack of context. And so we live in the world now where people have opinion without responsibility. And so I think it's a challenge for anybody who's in leadership to have thick skin, to be able to know that those opinions are being made without the responsibility of having to lead, and to understand that if you've done the right thing based on what you have in your information and based on what you've been given, you can double down on that philosophy and that theory to do it again. If not, the criticism sometimes informs you about yourself that you need to change a thing or two, maybe evolve some. So there's an education of the criticism too, to be able to take that in and count. In account for how you lead in the future. So yeah, I would say criticism is just a part of leadership. You know, it means people are watching. I said this when I was in Houston, I think it's so true, is that, you know, I think one of the things that we don't realize, you know, and most people don't quite understand, is sometimes criticism is dressed up care, right? It's like, it's repurposed care. And so when fans really care, or when a parent really cares, it's repurposed care. Like, they really care about their son's playing time. And so that's why they're frustrated. And so one of the greatest ways that you can, you know, be able to view criticism more helpfully is to say, hey, these fans really care. They really want us to get it right. Right. Or this parent really wants me to get it right. And whether or not I can get it right in this conversation is a different subject. But I know that their criticism of me is because they really, really care and they want to get it right. And that allows me to see it with more healthy eyes and hear it with a more pure heart, and then repurpose, hopefully, it into better actions.
Yeah, I love that perspective. And I like to default back to some of Annie Duke's work, where she talks about, you know, that our decision making is really about betting. I mean, we're educated guessers when it comes down to being coaches, right? And so the more information we have, typically the more informed our guesses can be. But as you said, we're not always going to get them right. We're going to have an opportunity to learn from that. And even drawing from what you talked about earlier in terms of understanding our players by zooming out, I think that's something that I've learned through some trials as well, about trying to understand parents, is, you know, zooming out a little bit and trying to understand a better context from where that comes from. And I think you're right. You know, another perception, and point this to a fan base or a parent group or whatever, I'd rather have a kid that's in a home where the parents really care about their outcomes than a home where they don't have any parents at all, you know, or a parent that's totally disengaged from their child's life and development. And so, you know, sometimes just our framing can make a big difference, you know, in those situations as well. I think another thing, and I'd be curious, is your perspective on this, Jack, is as we go through, you know, and JP referenced my last job before where I'm at now, where I was asked to resign in the middle of the year, which is a whole nother story. I'll send you the podcast on those. But When we go through some of those challenging times and criticisms and our decision making, you know, our decisions don't work out the way that we hope to, I think it can be a challenge for coaches to maintain their confidence going into the next thing, you know, whether it's their own ability, whether it's their own, just, you know, there's a thing about being authentic, but then there's also that internal battle of, is, am I still enough, even who I believe I am to be, you know? And so as you've kind of gone through and you've navigated some ups and downs in your career, how do you try to protect that confidence, you know, in who you are and your competency to be able to continue to move forward?
Well, let me go back to, because you just said something really awesome. I don't want us to skip over here that I think is really, Martin Luther King is one of my heroes. I've read every biography or autobiography about him that I could find, because he is obviously was a faith leader who led with courage and dignity, and had multiple jobs, right? He was a minister. He was a civil rights leader. He did several things for his dad. And so I have always ascribed to not allow my job to be the premier identity in my life, but my faith and my family to be how I identify and or walk through life. And then whatever job we have, we do the best we can do with it. And I think I've been blessed to do good jobs everywhere I've been to make sure I'm making a difference in those people. But one thing he said that's really powerful is opposite of, you know, love isn't hate, right? It's indifference. And so you mentioned that earlier. I think, Nate, that is a very big point that every listener needs to hear, is like somebody criticizing a call that you make in the fourth quarter or potentially criticizing a move I made as an administrator. You know, that's actually a dressed up form of love. And so, again, love and hate have different opposite, you know, representations. But if they don't care, that's when it's dangerous, right? That apathy sets in. That's the one where you're trying to coach effort, you know, or you're trying to coach care. It's really dangerous. And that's when, you know, quite frankly, you're probably in the wrong spot or potentially need to repurpose a lot of different things. So I want everybody to hear that, is that we live in an emotionally volatile world right now. People want headlines. They want news to be, you know, click-worthy and all those things. And so, yeah, you can't go for that. You can't allow yourself to be prompted by that. But man, we sure, you know, as a leader, want to make sure that people care. And so there's an extreme to it, is what I'm saying. But in the end, you want to be careful that you don't allow that extreme emotion to begin to make you want to tell people to care less. Because if you do that, then you're really messed up. But your question about how to restore confidence, you know, on the backside of adversity. You know, listen, I would say this. I think if you see yourself as a leader, whether it's, again, high school, college, or professional sports, is you see it as a group of people, right? Like, it's not just Nate, the coach. It's Nate, the program builder, Nate and his communication with his assistants, his communication with the people who run the gym, his communication with the people he buys the uniforms with. If you see it as that association, then you're going to be less fragile in relationship to your own evaluation on the backside of adversity. So for me personally, right, like I was not that different in Houston than I was in New England or Kansas City or South Carolina, right? And when I was in South Carolina, we were blessed to win national championships in baseball. You know, obviously, you know, Dawn Staley and I have a great friendship. She's an amazing coach. We built kind of the foundational building blocks. She was getting going when I was leaving. In Houston, you know, we had won division championship, and then after that had a couple of seasons that were challenging. And I don't know how different I was in those different environments, right? I probably did things wrong in all of them, probably did some things right in each one of them. But I think you realize it's the group, right? It's the group. It's everybody. You need help. You need people that are bought into a common goal. You need people that are bought into a selfless mission. You need people that give honest feedback. And so I think that even if you're just a small staff of you and an assistant or you and the parents, I think you have to see it as bigger than yourself. Because if you only focus on, well, I didn't do this and I didn't do that, or I'm not good enough at this, then that over critique of yourself is going to result in the confidence being fragile. But I just think if you're a high school coach, you got to remember the AD, the principal, the parents, the equipment managers, all that stuff is a factor in how you identify and how confident you should be in that overall program, not just your ability to stand in front of the team and say the right thing or call the right play or draw up something in a timeout. You don't ever take the global assessment of whether or not you should be confident based on those small things, because that'll make you fragile.
Well, I can just speak to you and what I know about you. And we had a conversation on this podcast when I was first just getting it off the ground years and years ago when you were in New England, and you stayed humble through that experience. I know you stayed humble, and you just speak to that too, of just like, I think there was that saying, you know, when the team wins, it's the players, you know, it's the coach, you know, the team loses, it's the coach, you know, like there's just that staying humble and willing to take on the burden, but at the same time, knowing internally, like, I'm not the determining factor when we have success, and I'm not the determining factor when we, you know, the only factor when we lose or not winning. So that's a great reminder for coaches. I just got two quick questions before we get you out of here. You've given so much of your time today, which we appreciate. The first question is just, how do you want to continue to serve people moving forward? You know, are you open to sharing a little bit about your plans or just some of your desires, you know, moving forward in the world of sports or maybe beyond that?
Yeah, so I think obviously, you know, our family is in a really good place. I think we're evaluating all options. I think geographically and from a positionally, what may be best. I think for me, I think I'm gifted to lead. I think I'm called to lead. I think that I've been blessed with international sports relationships, both on the business side and on the professional. Actual sporting side, to be able to help build an entity of some type. Is that a sports conglomerate? Is that an athletic department? Is that a football team? I'm not sure yet. I've had discussions with all of those. I feel really good about the lessons coming out of Houston, and obviously the lessons from each step that you guys have referenced on this podcast. I feel very healthy, very encouraged, charged to be able to go and lead. I've been, as you mentioned, JP, I've been blessed to, I'm only 39 years old and been blessed to be a part of national championships and Super Bowls and different things success-wise. So I think we have a lot to offer, and I think it's about match and alignment and making sure that whatever the entity is, that there's really good alignment and or potential upside of that entity growing and a vision being identified and then fulfilled. And so we're just really taking it in and have met with major sports, met with NBA leaders and, you know, Major League Baseball leaders, and then obviously some NFL leaders, just to continue to evaluate where I could serve best. And I'm open to anything and excited about what that will be in leadership next.
Well, last question, and then Nate's got one quick one for you too, is every time you recommend a book, I read it, right? So I need a book recommendation from you. And also we need a recommendation for another guest to have on a podcast, a leader or a coach in the sports world that you think, you know, could definitely benefit us and many of our many listeners.
There's a book called A Tale of Three Kings. Okay.
Okay.
Gene Edwards, Tale of Three Kings. And the reason it's an older book and it's not maybe even relevant to all of the audience, but this specific book, I actually started reading because of some of the challenges of the anti-Semitism that was going on and some of the different things in relationship to Jewish history. That I felt I needed to be educated on. Gene talks about three different kings. So David, Saul, and Absalom in the Jewish faith, kings of Israel, and how they led differently and how they led in a way that was very different, and yet they're from the same family, right? They're literally in succession. And so I think being able to understand the differences of leaders and how you can make progress doing it differently, but yet obviously the differences are felt by the people around you. I think that is really, grown me in a way just here recently, understanding some of the history of how that impacted the nation of Israel. And then obviously some of the things we've gone on in our country, we've had some really different leaders, right? When you're talking about just the president of the United States, you look at how different these people have been, right? From Obama to Trump to Biden, right? There's just a lot of differences in that, regardless of where you stand politically. So I've been challenged by that. Would love to recommend that book as a different is okay. But you just want to know how those differences will impact those around.
And is there a leader that you'd recommend for us to check out to bring on as a guest on the podcast here that you just think is exceptional?
Gosh, you know, let's see. Have you had Greg Sankey, SEC commissioner? Have you had him?
Mm-mm. No.
Yeah. So I think that would be my recommendation. I think Greg is very authentic, very honest. He's a runner. He's very academic. He's smart. He's a good person. And I think the conference alignment in American sports is going to determine a lot of how this revenue model and NIL is sustainable. And so, yeah, if you could get Greg, he's a reader. He's a incredible learner, took over for Roy Kramer. And obviously with this, you know, Power Five movement, of what was is now in the rear view, he established the SEC as the premier conference in our country, and then now has doubled down on that by adding some market share here with Texas and Oklahoma. So I think, yeah, I'd recommend him. I think he's a great human and a really, really, really smart leader.
Mm. All right, Jack, we're going to get you out of here on this. We're coming back full circle to the first question about the secret weapon. Is you and I share a common answer when it comes to what is the secret weapon for team building? And I think we can agree that wiffle ball is part of that equation. So why don't you tell us about your experience with wiffle ball, and we'll get the listeners out of here on that.
That's right. Well, you know, it's funny when you want to do a team building exercise, you want to do something that everybody can have success at, right? So sometimes when you're shooting basketball or you're playing golf, you got a lot of people out there who don't know what they're doing, and they're failing miserably trying to, you know, hit the ball in a fairway or potentially shoot a jump shot. And obviously you also open up, you know, injury risk. So I've been blessed to be a part of a lot of different team building, strategies for national teams and or offices. And, we've done things in Houston and in New England and Kansas City and South Carolina, where we've taken group of administrators or we're doing something together to try to, you know, build camaraderie. And wiffle ball seems to, the reaction time is not quite as fast. You can widen your demographic. You can create a little competition through allowing everybody to hopefully participate. Your pitcher, obviously it depends on what type of ball you use. You know, if you've got a ball with all, you know, holes on one side or holes all the way through it, you know, your pitcher can quickly shut everybody out if you know what you're doing. But I've loved having people over to our house. When I was in South Carolina, we had a backyard where we played wiffle ball all the time. And then in New England, we were blessed to holidays. A lot of times we would bring people over and my wife would cook a big meal or we would do something. And then we would have an opportunity hopefully to fellowship with wiffle ball. So don't know if I'm the best wiffle ball player, but it's a great fellowship event to, you know, lower the threshold where everybody can have some success and have some fun and camaraderie and pull for each other without injury risk being too high.
Amen, brother.
This is awesome. Thanks so much for giving us so much of your time today, Jack. We appreciate it.
You guys are blessed and all the best. Thank you, JP, for what you're doing too, to encourage people. I think, you know, like I mentioned in a news cycle in a time period where news cycles sometimes can, you know, drain the energy of leaders. You've chosen to invest in people and that love and truth deposit every day into others is the selfless sacrifice, the thing God calls us to do. So thank you for you fulfilling that calling. And just, again, look up to you for what you've accomplished since college and how you've carried yourself over and over and over in every interaction. So keep that up, man. Double down. And Nate, great to meet you. If you're with JP, I know you're good people. So just humbled by this overlap.
Okay, a huge thank you to Jack for coming to the podcast to talk about his experiences, to be vulnerable and willing to share. I'm grateful for his influence in my life as well as the impact he has had on so many others. If you want the notes to today's episode, go to tocculture.com. There you can also learn about our online courses and our one-on-one coaching program for coaches. Also, don't forget to check out The Culture System, a proven process for creating an extraordinary team culture.